This edition of Community and Unity was recorded on February 16th, 2017, in the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage.
Welcome to all of you to Community and Unity. It's a community dialogue series, and unlike previous events, this really is an intimate, personal conversation. Today we're focusing on what it's like to experience a mental illness with the hopes of educating the community so that people better understand. So I'd like to start, because we're such a small group, going around in a circle, talking about why we're here. My name is Anne Hillman. I'm the host of this program. And I chose this topic because mental illness really does impact everyone in our community, whether we know it or not. And so I feel like having a conversation to help other people better understand it can help make our community a stronger place.
I'm Anthony. I just came here tonight just because I do have a lot of people in my life who have struggled with mental illness. So I just wanted to hear more from other people's experiences and sort of find out how I can best support those in my own life.
I'm Dr. Shirley Saucerman, and my brother was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 19 years old after he was accepted to med school. And I've spent the last almost 50 years trying to help him and other people recover. I noticed when he fasted 2 days or ate a plant-based diet, his mind was clear.
My name is Francine Harbour. I'm a person in recovery from mental illness, and I had two parents and an older sister who had mental illness.
Hi, my name is Bonnie, and I have bipolar, and I came here tonight because I wanted to be of support. And it sounded interesting to me.
Hi, my name is Amy, and I have 7 family members who have mental illness, including myself. So I thought I'd like to share.
My name is Monica, and I too suffer from mental health issues. I want to share my story and help others with mental illness live happier lives.
I'm Penny. And I feel honored to be here and be able to share my story too. I too also have mental health issues that have plagued me through my life, and I wanted to be able to share that as well.
My name's Jen, and I came because I'm very interested in this topic. My family, there's a lot of history of mental illness just across the board, so the more I can learn and hear, the better I am.
For those of you who are experiencing a mental illness, I was wondering, Francine, if you could start, can you kind of tell us a little bit about how you were first diagnosed? What made you first think that you wanted to look into the issue?
Back in 1988, yes, that long ago, I had gone to a class at my church called Healing the Inner Child. Yes, it was that long ago when we started talking about our inner child. After the class, I realized I probably had more difficulties in that class was going to be able to handle, so I started counseling and was eventually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Like I said, both my parents and my older sister dealt with pretty serious mental illness. The living scene was chaotic and could even be very abusive. So when a child experiences that environment growing up, they often experience trauma, and if the trauma is not resolved right away, it turns into post-traumatic stress disorder. And mine developed or presented itself, it manifested when my oldest son became the age when I started being traumatized. And that often happens. And then, so I did 4 years of really intensive PTSD therapy, got to a point that seemed pretty stable, pretty happy, or happier anyway. Time went by, and in 2000, I had gone without sleep for 3 nights. I had a psychotic episode, meaning basically that I had lost touch with reality, and I started walking around the neighborhood late at night, and eventually ended up at Providence, where I was diagnosed as having bipolar disorder, and I stopped working at that time. I'm a retired attorney. And I spent the next number of years on disability status and got well. You know, it took a long time. Lots of different medications, different kinds of therapies. NAMI, I'm a member of NAMI Anchorage. I've been for a long time. And slowly gathered my wits back so that I could return to work eventually.
When you say that the PTSD manifested itself, what was that like? What were your experiences like?
Well, it wasn't super dramatic. I did have nightmares, but they weren't night terrors. I had flashbacks, but not the type where I hit the ground thinking, you know, bullets were straying or something like that. It was more subtle than you often see depicted maybe in movies or TV shows. But it was enough that I was having what are called intrusive thoughts, where thoughts that you don't want bothering you at the time keep coming into your mind. And that's one of the four symptoms of PTSD. And then the other big symptom, which I didn't realize until I came to understand what it is avoidance. I mean, you just avoid anything that gives you a trigger that it's something like what was abusive before. So that had just been a big issue for me. It took a lot of education to even understand what the illness was before I could start recognizing the symptoms in myself. The depression was easy to recognize. And then once I understood about the mania side of it, I could understand where some of my behavior was supposedly manic on the high side, but that didn't last very long. So now my current counselor is kind of wondering whether it's just not been post-traumatic stress disorder all along, just that, and the manifestations of that. But it's too late because the stigma will stay with me for life because I'm on the internet because of a prior video interview I gave as being a suicide attempt survivor who has bipolar disorder. So I'm stuck with that for life.
Monica, you also experienced PTSD.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the stigma and to other issues later, but Monica, I'd like you to talk about your personal experiences. What has it been like for you?
I was diagnosed PTSD probably six or seven years ago, actually. I realized I had mental illness when I actually started attending counseling for drug addiction. And I did a project with one of the counselors is going back over my life history, what happened, what I had done. And she says, I can't do this with you because I can't process it with you, but I went ahead and did it anyway. And it brought up, I realized, wow. But even then, I really wasn't diagnosed. I probably wasn't diagnosed for another 10 years. I was self-medicating with drugs from the time I was 14, or maybe even 13, actually. My first suicide attempt was at 14. I have probably had at least a dozen suicide attempts in my life. The last one I almost didn't make it out of. And that's when they diagnosed me with the PTSD.
Mm-hmm. When you were finally diagnosed, what kind of difference did that make to you? How did that impact you? Or did it?
Actually, when I first started going over my history, I was actually adamant about working things out.
What do you mean working things out?
Working out the issues I was having. I was molested at 14. For about 6 months, and when I told my mother about it, she'd made my life so miserable I couldn't stay home. So at 14, I was out on my own. And I went to prostitution, and I didn't understand I was having a problem until I actually started doing my history. And I knew I had a problem, and I thought, okay, counseling, a little bit of counseling there, but it didn't solve the problem because I couldn't really talk about the issues I was having. I didn't understand them, and I wasn't working with a mental health counselor. I was working with a drug counselor. And for the longest time, drug counselors said you cannot work on your personal problems until you have clean time under your belt. And they're saying 6 months, 2 years, you have to have clean time under your belt or you can't work or you'll relapse.
And it's actually the opposite of that. What we know now is that the treatment has to be integrated. Mm-hmm. They both have to be, the drug abuse problem and the mental health problem has to be handled at the same time, because if you don't, one will submarine the other.
Yeah.
It'll undercut it. Mm-hmm. And so for decades, literally decades, the mental health profession and the substance abuse, chemical dependency profession have been going like this. You know, one points to the other, so you have to take care of your mental illness first and then come see us at substance abuse, and the substance abuse have been saying you got to take care of your mental illness first and then
you because you can't, because you'll relapse.
But from the way you're describing it, they're interrelated.
They are. They are. I was self-medicating for the abuse. I was self-medicating the pain of the abuse, even though it was it's way back in my history. I'm 53 now. So at 14, I'm being molested, and the pain is still there because I'm starting to deal with it now, but it's still, it's not an overnight cure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Monica had an intuitive sense, which is that she, way back when, which she needed to handle both at the same time. You said that you wanted to talk about these things,
yeah.
and the chemical dependency counselor said, no, I can't handle that. So back then, she knew they were related, at some level, she knew they were interrelated, mm-hmm. but because of the profession, they keep the treatment separate, and that's why we've had problems, we've had lack of success longer than we needed to, because those of us who experienced the conditions weren't listened to.
Have either of you had similar experiences to this, where you felt like the person that you were turning to for help wasn't listening?
Well, like Francine was saying, I felt like the counselor couldn't deal with it, so they said, no, we have to deal with something else. And it was a therapist who couldn't deal with it, who wanted to just stick to something else because they did not want to deal with it.
Because they didn't know how to, or they just didn't want to, or you don't know?
I don't think they wanted to, or they could handle it.
Like,
I don't know which one.
Competency point? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've talked to several other people who've had that happen.
I'm not sure it was all competency. I think it's the regulations.
Oh,
they couldn't.
I wasn't suggesting everybody was competency.
Yeah. But it's they couldn't. They couldn't separate. They couldn't combine them.
They were siloed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not with me.
Okay.
We're talking about another time.
Another time. Yeah.
Yeah.
This wasn't that long. That long ago.
Okay.
But I've talked to other people whose therapists were the same way. No, we can't deal with it right now. No, they did not want to deal with it.
What had you gone to a counselor to talk about?
Well, I'd had my marriage break up and, you know, different things and childhood trauma and sexual abuse. And it was a sexual abuse that they're not going to, let's not deal with that, but she did not want to deal with it. I mean, if someone feels like they need to talk about something, they need to talk about it.
Do you feel like talking about it with a therapist helps you? In what?
Later on it did, but it was another therapist.
Mm. So sometimes that relationship makes a big
mm-hmm.
difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a huge difference.
Makes all the difference.
And I found out that when you ask the therapist, and she just kept putting it off, are you qualified to deal with past sexual abuse? When they say yes, it doesn't mean they are. It means that's what their insurance takes yours, or they can take your insurance. that might sound shallow of me, but it's what I've experienced.
Penny, I see you over there just nodding away. Tell us a little bit about your experiences.
Oh my heck, when you brought out the therapist not listening, well, as a patient, I wasn't listening either. I have, what's it called, dissociative identity disorder. And a lot of times when I was in therapy, I wasn't there. I don't remember the sessions. I didn't get anything out of them because I wasn't there. Mentally, I guess you would call it that. Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit what dissociative identity disorder is,
mm-hmm.
just for people who don't know?
It usually happens because of being abused as a child. It's if you know the movie Split, that's kind of what's going on. No, she doesn't want me to talk about that.
Well, this is you expressing. So basically, there's periods of time where you're present and the periods of time that other aspects of your
yes.
personality are present
but
instead.
But I'm integrated now. But that's what was going on throughout my life. So I had really strange behaviors, some of which I remember and some of which I don't. And people would come to me and say, did you know you did thus and so? And I go, no, I didn't know that. So there's large periods of my life that I don't know what happened. And it wasn't until I was diagnosed recently, as of 5 years ago, mm-hmm. 3 or 5 years ago, that I even knew that this was going on. And when it was presented to me, I was like, call me schizophrenic, but don't call me, you know, multiple personality. It totally freaked me out.
Why?
Because the first thing you think of is Sybil. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how scary that is, you know. So I've had a lot of therapists, but nobody broke through. Because it wasn't until, now I'm in my 60s. So I finally have a life where I'm here all the time. And it's great. It's so great. But it took my entire life to get to this point.
How did you said that you finally integrated your personalities. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about that? I think mm-hmm. I think this process of recovery is something people don't necessarily get to hear about.
Well, I think it's important that we have the right therapist. As Bonnie brought up, you know, you need to do some shopping around sometimes. I happen to...
You can waste your time on a therapist that isn't for you.
Yeah. I've been pretty lucky, really lucky, have a therapist that actually works with children. She does play therapy. And with her help over the last 4 years, we had figured out we had been together 4 years, twice a month. With play therapy, I'm integrated, which means all of my selves. And I have about 4 or 5, but none of them are violent. And the changes are very subtle. So it's like in a movie, you know, people would shut their eyes and then they'd come out and they'd be another person. Mine was a lot more subtle than that.
So popular media was really feeding into, it sounds like, even the image you had of yourself when you were diagnosed.
Yeah.
Have others of you found that to be true, that images that are put forth in the media are influencing first how you see yourself and then how others are seeing you?
Well, I am particularly upset about Split, the movie.
I am too. My gosh.
NAMI National did a lot to try to get the producer and director to, if not pull that movie, then at least have some types of information that would fight the stigma associated with is no such thing anymore as multiple personality disorder. Mm. Get it out of your vocabulary. It doesn't exist. It's now called dissociative identity disorder, and we all dissociate. Dissociate is basically daydreaming, and with people who have suffered abuse, the quote-unquote daydreaming can become bad enough that a person's mind adopts different selves or states, not personalities, selves or states.
Or parts.
Mm-hmm. And the objective is to try to bring to the surface the different selves or states or parts, and then to integrate them with each other so that you have a whole in the moment present being. You'll remain aware of those selves, but you won't be slipping into those different selves as a way to cope with the trauma, which is what people who have...
She doesn't need to do that anymore.
I know when I was in my addiction, I had 3 different distinct
states.
Yeah, I had had Mikey, which is my little girl, Monica, who is the know-it-all and control, and Mike was the mediator. And I was conscious of all 3 of them. Mike wasn't around a whole lot, but Mikey was my child, and I actually had a friend that encouraged her.
Yeah, and that's the reason I get up so upset with a movie like Split. Because first of all, it talks about victimizing children, and that's just unacceptable in any situation.
Number one, yeah.
The other thing, it feeds right into the stigma that people with mental illness are violent, mm-hmm. deliberately, intentionally. There's a part of us that will always be set on hurting somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so no matter how well I get, And I'm really well right now. No matter how well I get, as long as somebody knows I have mental illness, I will always carry that stigma. I will never get away from it. It doesn't matter if someone, you know, put a stamp of approval on me that I was 100% well, that stigma will always follow me. And that's why I greatly resent movies like Split. There may be some artistic elements to it that may be laudatory. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I wouldn't be able to see it because it would trigger my PTSD.
Oh, there's no way I could see that movie. Not even as entertainment.
I don't see myself as being stigmatized. I am actually pretty upfront with even strangers. I have a big problem with boundaries. I will say some things that I probably shouldn't say when I first meet people. But I don't have a problem with my past, my addiction issues. I don't have a problem with them. I am who I am because of my life experience.
Well, I'm a totally disclosed consumer. You know, I'm like a poster child. I've done lots of TV shows and radio shows and speaking in front of people. Nonetheless, even though people know what my story is and that I'm in recovery, I resent the fact that somebody else can draw a conclusion based about me just based on a stigmatized illness. Mm-hmm. People should not be able to prejudge anybody,
no.
But especially prejudge me because I once had these labels.
What do you feel like are some of the judgments people are making about you? And this is open to everyone. What stereotypes do you think are associated with mental illness?
Well, the biggest one is violence, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. I think that has a lot to do with all the criminals that are claiming mental illness for their actions.
Well, the FBI statistics for years have been of all the people who commit violent crimes in the country, over time, it's remained pretty consistent that 3% of those people had a mental health condition. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that most of the crimes in the country are being committed by people, by the 97% of people who are just plain angry.
Yeah.
They're angry and they're vengeful and they're mean. You know, that's not a mental illness.
But you often hear the stat that, like, a majority of the people who are in DOC, Department of Corrections, is one of the biggest mm-hmm. mental health providers in the state. Mm-hmm. And I mean, is that simply because people, why is that?
Many times people with a mental illness in our criminal justice system have come off of psychotropic medications too rapidly. The medications are very powerful and people are taken off too rapidly, particularly at the very end of stopping medication. It often needs to be a very, very slow amount at the end, or people can have behavior that indecent exposure or something else that ends them up in the criminal justice system. My brother was in med school on a low dose of psychotropic meds. He was also taken off rapidly in jail when the dose was taken off too rapidly.
So often people end up in the criminal justice system simply because there's not other care available,
right.
And not because they're actually...
Well, for some reason, the care they need, whatever the case may be, they're not getting or get stopped too soon, or like you end up in jail because you were picked up for, quote-unquote, exposing yourself, when in your state of mind, because of your mental illness, all you were doing was going to the bathroom. I mean, there's absolutely no sense of this is a wrong thing to do, and you get picked up, you get slapped either with a misdemeanor, or if there happens to be a child in the vicinity of where you just happen to innocently go to the bathroom, then you get slapped with a felony, and maybe even a sex offender charge.
Yeah. Or you're self-medicating.
You better explain that better, because it's
self-medicating is you're doing drugs, doing illicit
to do
drugs.
For what purpose?
To stop the pain.
Right, to lower the symptoms.
Yeah,
to the mental illness symptoms.
Yeah. To block the pain, to block the thoughts, to feel accepted.
To feel accepted?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a bit more? I mean,
I've always felt an outcast. Even growing up, I mean, my best friend in grade school, actually probably my only real friend, because I moved around a lot, in fifth and sixth grade, was the kid that the fat kid that nobody liked that helped the janitor take the trash out after lunch. That was my, and I would walk around with him and help him with his trash. That was my best friend.
Do you think that you felt that low self-esteem like a lot of us did because we had been abused, even though it wasn't in our minds?
Yes.
We didn't say, I'm abused, therefore I'm less.
And this was before the molestation. Oh. But, so there was something earlier in my life that happened that I don't really know, but I always had low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. I've always had it. And doing the drugs fit me into a circle that I had another family. I had a family.
Mm-hmm. And that's no different than college guys and gals go to the pub after school and they want to feel a little loose and better, you know, better able to socialize. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that for social purposes you drink and it takes off the intimidation. What happens with people who are self-medicating mental health symptoms is it takes more to get rid of the symptoms. And then if addiction happens to kick in, if that process of addiction, which is a brain process, mm-hmm. happens to kick in, there you go.
We were talking about that in the peer-to-peer, that dual diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those people are thrown in jail for just using, not even selling or anything else, just for using because they're caught. And then
let's admit it. If we're drunk or we're taking drugs, or we're screaming at the moon because we're manic, we're most likely, and we're out in public, mm-hmm. we're probably, quote, misbehaving, you know, either a disruption to the, I can't remember what it's called, disrupting the community, or...
Disturbing the peace.
Disturbing the peace. I mean, it's not like we're totally innocent babes. We can really act out when we're having, you know, I'm just saying we have to admit that we don't always behave so well when we're having symptoms.
I think now I was very lucky. 3.5 years ago, I had a psychotic break.
What does that mean?
I just broke with reality. Oh, God, man, I thought I could read minds. I thought I was all powerful and, you know, everything was so grandiose. I mean, I was a year younger than my dad was when he had his psychotic break. I think in my family, it's hereditary. And I was just lucky that my family did get involved now, or I'm sure I would have been arrested getting naked somewhere. I know people get arrested for that, but sometimes I think, I didn't do that, but I can see myself doing that. And sometimes I think when I hear of people being arrested, why would somebody get naked in public if there wasn't something wrong? Why are they arrested? You know?
So there's a couple things that you mentioned that I'd love to jump on. One, you said that your illness is hereditary.
Yes.
And I feel like a lot of this conversation has been mental illnesses that are stemming from abuse, but yours is neurochemical.
Definitely. Well, my dad, he had his in 1990, and there wasn't much that I ever found on it except for the book Call Me Anna by Patty Duke. And I was so grateful, you know, something to read on it. And then later on, she came out with other people, the book A Brilliant Madness. And I think I was kind of prepared. I mean, because for years I was worried it was going to happen to me. And anything, magazine article, anything, I found it so interesting. So I think when it happened, I just didn't care what people thought.
You're listening to Community and Unity, Experiencing a Mental Illness. This episode was recorded on February 16th, 2017 in the Alaska Public Media Studios.
If someone is having an episode in public, so if someone is shouting out things during a public event or is obviously experiencing something that other people aren't experiencing, what should members of the general public do? Like how, if anything, how do we help? How do we not help?
Well, we're very lucky in Anchorage. We have a crisis intervention team within the Anchorage Police Department. Fantastic, empathetic, educated people. These are mostly police officers, but also dispatchers,
people from Office of Children's Services, people from any kind of law enforcement type of activity. Those are the people who can get trained to CIT officers or trainees. And what that you can call them, you can simply call 911. If someone's in the middle of the street, for example, screaming and taking their clothes off because they're having a psychotic episode, you can call 911 and say, dispatcher, I think there's someone with a mental illness in the middle of the street. Can you please have the CIT officers come?
Well, what if it's something smaller than that? What if it's just, you know, shouting during a performance or something?
Like as in a movie performance? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the managers have to take care of that. And everybody needs to know about these resources, these emergency resources. In this case, if the person wouldn't leave voluntarily, then you would have to call the police. Mm-hmm. That should be the rule. They shouldn't be able to manhandle anybody to get them to leave. And you always just want to try to remember, we have a specialized police unit here who, instead of hitting them with a, what's that stun thing called? The taser.
Then
you know, the typical officer may pull out his taser and tase the guy and drag him down the aisle. The CIT officers will de-escalate the situation and get the person to cooperate and do what the officer says. So that's the most important community resource to have in an emergency. Uh-huh. If it's not an emergency and a person just needs help or a family member needs help and support and education, then they call NAMI, our organization. If the person is homeless or is not someone who's in the mental health services system, not someone who's likely to go into the system, they can go to the Mental Health Consumer Web, which is where Monica works, and have a community, you know, people who are going to be keeping an eye on them anyway.
What happened with me is, this lasted about 3 weeks altogether, but my parents, they kept calling an ambulance on me and coming to my house, and you know, nobody can make you stay in a hospital. And then my dad knew somebody he talked to in with the police, and what happened is they finally had me arrested for trespassing at their house, where I spent the night at the Anchorage jail, and there I did get naked, and then, I mean, I don't know why, but, you know, you can't explain this. And the worst thing is, I remember everything I did. That's the worst. And then I made the mistake of saying, oh, I'm going to kill myself. So, which got me into Highland, the psychiatric unit, for about 4 days.
Highland Correctional Center. Mm-hmm.
Their psychiatric area.
Did that help? Was that good?
Oh, yes. They put me in just like a vest thing. I just had a cot and a bed and a pillow. And you cannot say, I'm not going to take any drugs. You'll get a shot in the butt. Which, you know, I needed the drugs. And anyway, so I spent 4 days there. And then they let me out. I don't have a record. It just says, trespassing charges were dropped. I can get a job anywhere. And I was so angry at them for doing it for a long time. You know, now I'm so grateful, you know. But, and it wasn't, they were all so nice to me at Highland. I mean, good food, you know. And then from there, I went home, and I'd spiraled down, and some of my thinking still wasn't clear, to where I drove myself to API, where I stayed for 8 days, and that was nice too. You know, I can't say any facility was bad.
That's positive news.
And yeah, when I was at API, three other women, we all hung out together, and we were all kind of in the same boat, shell-shocked that this had happened to us.
It's shell-shocked that it happened to you. It's completely unexpected for you.
Well, yeah, I'd never had anything like that in my life.
Did you start viewing yourself differently?
Well, I knew I'd had a sight. Well, the best thing that happened to me during this time is an officer came to the house.
A CIT officer.
A CIT officer came to the house, a policeman who's trained in this, and he gave me a magnet that talked about NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Mm-hmm. And I said, see, Mom, because my mother was there, you know, it's for you. And they kind of look at each other. And anyway, it was on my fridge. And I don't know where I would be without NAMI, because I did feel like a freak. And then I go, and people who'd experienced similar things, grandiose, all this, had gone through the same thing. And that was like a breath of fresh air. And I still go to meetings. And the most inspiring thing to me is still when I see a newcomer, mm-hmm. and they're like just this last Saturday, and she had had a psychotic break. When we all talk to her and tell her our experiences, and Francine,
She came in ashamed, like most newcomers do. Mm-hmm. You know, head down.
Oh yeah.
Won't look you in the eye, and so she explained. Well, actually, we asked her what had happened, because she wouldn't mm-hmm. volunteer at first. She's young, 22 years old, and so she finally explains what happened during her psychosis, and she still has her head down. And then we each talk about our episode. We talk about our episodes, and we laugh. We giggle a little, because, like, oh, well, you know, that's what happens when the brain loses track with reality. None of us did anything violent. None of us did anything criminal. I don't even think any of us did anything to bother our family members. We just, you know, I started walking in the middle of the night because I was unhappy with Alaska, and I was going to walk home to Washington State. And I just started walking down the road. I mean, that made perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
I was just going to walk down the glen and, you know, keep going. And
the stigma. When I started taking medication for my issues, my husband says, well, you got help getting off of drugs. Because he was doing drugs and he had no issue. Well, I imagine he did. He just wasn't facing them. Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think most addicts do have some kind of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he says, well, you had help getting off drugs. I didn't. That's why I can't get off. It was because I was getting medications to help me with the mental health issues that we still hadn't known what they were at that point in time, that I was getting help. It was medication that I needed, that I had needed all along, but didn't know.
But in a way, isn't that true? Because if the mental health illness and the symptoms are what's prompting us to self-medicate, well, whatever it is, drugs, alcohol, food, in my case, mm-hmm. You know, whatever it may be, if we get the medication and the mental health symptoms go down, then the compulsion to use goes down.
Yeah.
So he wasn't exactly wrong, was he, when he said you got help?
No, he was putting me down because I got help.
Oh, that was a bad thing.
Yes.
Oh, that happens a lot with the, it's bad to take psych drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like in the general population, people, like how do people react when you talk about your diagnoses or when you talk about the fact that you have a mental illness?
Well, I make sure that the door is open. I think I had told you today I was able to talk to my hairdresser, and we started talking about NAMI. She told me that she had clients that had either mental illnesses themselves, such as depression or anxiety, or they have family members, or even she had a boyfriend that was in jail at the time because of a manic episode. So when I told her about NAMI, she was like, wow, this exists? This is great. And then that opened the door, so I said, well, I have bipolar mm-hmm. disorder. She's like, wow, what's that like? And we opened that door. And so that give and take is just, it's a part of education, which I've learned by being a part of NAMI, where before I would hide. But now the door is open.
And so all the times, I couldn't even begin to count all the times I've disclosed, either in a big room or one-on-one, I have always gotten the reaction, oh, I know someone who's affected by mental illness, or, oh, I wish I knew about that group, or something like, oh, you mean you can talk about that?
It's a weird stigma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
a weird stigma, because I've even heard people talk about somebody, oh, they're bipolar, and mm-hmm. then later on they tell me, oh, I'm bipolar. It's like,
oh, wait,
huh?
So people perpetuate the stigma. The people who are experiencing it do
it. Yeah, and it's like, what?
Well, some of it is a little bit of humor too, because, and that's what we have to, when we giggle, you know, we have to be a little careful because it's just one of our principles of support in NAMI is we embrace humor as healthy. I mean, we need to use humor to get through.
We're laughing at everything.
My mother had a mental health issue and she was raised in Germany and she came here. And at that point in time, it was all locked in the closet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Lock it away in the closet. Don't talk about it. Stuff it. So she put all that on me. And I'm sure part of mine is inherited. Mm-hmm. She still won't talk about it. To this day, still will not talk about it. The only support I really have, is my aunt. I have two aunts, but my one aunt, she's very supportive of me. And even still, she stops at one point. At 14, I should have been old enough to know to tell somebody that I was being molested. Mm-hmm. That was my fault, that I was being molested.
They do that. Yeah. And so the abuse is a little bit different because it comes from outside, the abuse. What you were asking about was endemic or biological because the illness is coming from inside of us. So there's like two different issues. I mean, there's two different causation factors, but it's still all, the brain is affected, you know, in different ways, but it's still a brain dysfunction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just that
it causes a chemical imbalance.
Well, with the abuse, the trigger for the illness is coming from outside, but it's still triggering all the stress hormones, and that's what that's how our brain gets messed up. Whereas the bipolar, the depression, the schizophrenia, the obsessive compulsive disorder, these are all endemic brain dysfunctions that originate, I guess, in the brain as opposed to being triggered from some kind of a force outside. Mm-hmm. That's the only way that trauma and the other illnesses I mentioned are quote unquote different. But the brain, the bottom line is something is not working in the brain the way we want it to. Mm-hmm. And it results in either feelings, behaviors, thinking, or perceptions that are off. And those are the four things that the brain does. And for example, with schizophrenia, if the perception part of it is wrong, you may feel like you have ants crawling on your arms, like a friend of mine did when she was having psychosis.
And that's why you see the addicts digging at their skin, and they feel that they've got bugs crawling all over them.
Because addiction can cause psychosis, like schizophrenia can cause psychosis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing that's kind of popped up occasionally throughout this conversation is mentioning families and how you interact with your families and they interact with you. And you, at the beginning of the conversation, mentioned that multiple of your family members had experienced mental illness. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to kind of talk about how you reacted to family members how you helped support them and how it was for you to learn that.
Well, first of all, my father had paranoia schizophrenia. And then I found out later that my mother was narcissistic. And then I found out that one sister was schizophrenic, the other was bipolar, my uncle PTSD, and another uncle PTSD.
And Buddy, your brother.
And my brother, paranoid schizophrenia.
What was it like to grow up around so many people? Did you realize?
No, I didn't think of mental illness at that time. I knew my father had mental illness because he would take a pill. Haldol, is that it?
Oh, my heck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once a day.
Long stuff.
Did you feel like you ended up being in a support role for family? If there was a psychotic episode in public or if other people were uncomfortable around family members?
Yeah, because we didn't have people visit us often. I don't know. I guess my father, because he was, home, supposedly taking care of me and my brother. But he couldn't take care of us. He couldn't be responsible for us. Mm. So my grandmother, got the papers and she became our legal guardian.
And for you, with your brother, what sort of support did you end up providing your brother with?
Well, mainly we went to med school together and then he dropped out after 2.5 years. But later, after my father had passed on, our family was very close. And most of the time, after he was diagnosed, our family lived together. And after my father died, just my mom and brother and I were up here. We noticed when my brother fasted 2 days, his mind was clear. So then we started experimenting, and at home we just kept low protein, plant-based, and then his mind was clear, but he would go out and eat higher protein, animal products, meat, fish, eggs, and then he would be very difficult to live with.
Wow.
So you could see changes within?
Dramatic changes.
And so there's, what we've come to appreciate is in mental illness, probably many illnesses, but mental illness too, there are different roads to wellness, and there are different things that professionals have us do that do not make us well. And some those of us who've been through the whole medication crapshoot, where we go from one medication to the next, you know, it can take us 3, 4, 5, 6 years to figure out what chemical concoction works. And then some of us may decide we want to stay on meds for the rest of our lives because we like the way we are on that set of meds. For other people, it causes real problems, terrible weight gain, terrible sleepiness, sedation, lots of other kinds of medications. And so, you know, people try other things. They can try supplements, they can try diet, they can try exercise. There's a lot of things that people should try. There's a big panoply of treatments out there. So it's a really good, if you, like Shirley has just been a hero with her brother. And Shirley was always trying to keep Charles healthy. And some, Charles, he's an adult. He's an adult person, you know, and you can't make any adult do what you want him to as a family member. You know, sometimes he would have his own ways. These illnesses are episodic. Mm-hmm. They happen, they remit. They happen, they remit. So anyway, just with Shirley's point is, you know, diet can be very important for some people. Mm-hmm. Medications is what it's going to take for other people. And, you know, there's just different ways of handling it for
or
different
people. Or the component of all different. Like, it, just for somebody that doesn't have a mental illness, it's just vital to do self-care, to exercise and eat well. And not that I'm a good example of that, but but to have enough sleep and look after your health. That works for those of us that have mental illness to do the same thing and to be consistent about that. And that's part of our health.
So, I mean, ultimately looking after your health, whether you have a mental illness or not, is the same.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just your physical, your mental health, your spiritual health, mm-hmm. family, friends, all-encompassing.
Holistic
activities, not just exercise. You know, go out and do something that you enjoy, hiking, go travel, do different things. Keep your life busy.
The best thing we can do to fight stigma is to keep getting the message across that it's a medical condition. It's a medical condition, just like any other medical conditions, with its own set of symptoms and its own set of treatments.
You didn't do anything. You can't prevent it. And education, you can be proactive in it. Uh-huh. For 3 years, I'd been okay. And then I had some real stress going on in my life. And I'm not even sure that was it. But, you know, I felt the racing thoughts and, you know, maybe some unrealistic thinking. And I checked myself in to the CRC, the Crisis Recovery Center. And just stayed for a couple of days, and they took care of some things, and, you know, I was fine. I didn't go through the big dramatic thing I did before, mm-hmm. and I went home, and I was better able to deal with what I had to deal with.
Because you were really self-aware.
Yeah. I mean, it was a nice place. They have had classes all day. A menu to choose from. Now I'm going to get people to go That's there.
They establish a routine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
structure.
Routine mm-hmm. is important. And a routine can have some variance, but routine, taking care of yourself. Get up in the morning, get dressed, go find something to do, whether you work or do volunteer. Find something to do. Don't just sit around the house and watch TV. As something I have to do is art. I have to do something artistic, not necessarily every day, but at least once a week, sometimes more often, depending on how stressed I am. I keep paint available at my house. I do all kinds of things.
Are these some of the strategies that you teach people? Because you're a peer mentor.
Yeah, I encourage the people that come to the group to share their own art.
And what Monica does also, which is not always so evident, you are a living example of recovery. Mm-hmm. They see you, the people in your group, they see you, they come to NAMI, newcomers to the illness see us. Oh, guess what? You can actually, you know, it's not quite like a flu. You don't recover to your pre-illness state, but these are all medical conditions. You can learn to manage these just like anybody else has to manage any other medical illness.
Like diabetes.
And so we end up having to work in professions or jobs where we're not going to be stigmatized because we have a mental health condition or a chemical dependency condition. We've recovered from it, and that's our strength in that job. But to get back to the stigma issue, if we try to get a job that's not in the mental health field or not in the chemical dependency field, and our background is known, you know, I'm not even sure if I had to, given what's on the internet now,
well,
I'm not even sure I'd make it to an interview.
The allowances that we have to make, or our illness too.
I know, but
like what?
I do artwork to keep healthy. I have to get out. If there's a lot going around me, a lot of stress, I can react. So I have to learn to curb that.
I think the allowances are, if we can't get up on a particular morning because our meds have really sedated us, we have to be allowed to come in later without being penalized. If there comes a particular point that, you know, working 5 days a week for 2 or 3 months has been too much, I need to pull back.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you can start working 4 days a week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of allowances. If I know
you.
At one point, Avi, when you were working for the federal government, they literally put her in a corner by herself because of her symptoms, which they really are not allowed to do under law. But that was what they should have been doing instead, is pulling you in and making and not making fun of her because of her symptoms and having her be integrated with the group. That shouldn't even be an allowance. That should just be a normal thing that a good employer would do.
Avi, do you want to talk about how that made you feel?
Oh, I felt isolated. I felt betrayed. I felt annoyed, you know, because they would stand up and talk to each other about me as if I wasn't there when I was right there beside them. And they would say stigmatizing words. I can't think of an example right now, but they did.
How did you ever communicate with them about this and how this made you feel?
No, I didn't. No, I got my papers from my doctors. You know, it's talking about my mental illness so that I could retire on mental illness. Yeah.
No, that's being too kind to the federal government. They pushed you into it.
How common is your story? Have you heard many other people with similar situations, people who are pushed out?
Yes, I've heard that, especially in the groups that we have at NAMI. That's part of a lot of people's story.
It's either we're pushed out or we're not allowed back in. We have our recovery period. Just like someone had a heart attack, they have a recovery period. They have to change their lives. They have to change their diet and their exercise. There's plenty of self-maintenance things they have to do, take their medicine, but they're allowed back in. You know, they get rehired and go back to the same boss. We're not, because we have, it's almost like having a criminal record. You know, we're not considered hireable, or they're too concerned. Well, you know, yeah, I see you're in recovery and you've been healthy for a long time, but you know, I know you could blow up because you have bipolar disorder, and that's what people with bipolar disorder do. You know,
they eventually
go crazy enough that they're going to have a burst. Yeah, so they don't want to take the chance that they're the human resources person who hired you, and then later you have, you know, 5 years later you have a manic episode.
You have manic, yep. But they don't want, like when the postman started going postal. They're afraid.
But we don't know that person had a mental illness. He could have just been angry.
I know, but that's what they refer to.
That's what they think is going to happen.
That's what they think. We're going to go postal.
Well, I feel really lucky.
You are lucky, yeah.
I work for the state, and because of our great health insurance, I've been able to get all the treatment that I need. Plus, you know, my my work has been able to communicate with my doctor, specifically the one in the hospital, who said, okay, under the handicap law, these are what Penny needs. And they accommodate that in my workplace.
Can you give one example?
One of them is, you know, we talked about the isolation thing. Well, for me, I'm easily overwhelmed. So I'm put in a little corner, you know, there's people around me, but I don't necessarily have to be in the center of it. So that helps me cope better and work better. And they recognize that, and I have had many supervisors, you know, when you're in government, they keep changing who you're working under. But I've had really supportive supervisors and managers who know what I have and include me anyway. And I, kudos to the state.
Yeah, but also kudos to you, Penny, because you work really hard. Yeah. You work hard with customers who are really upset because you're trying to garnish their checks.
Well, I work with employers, though. Well, it's not so bad.
But the thing is, the point is that they are giving you a chance to demonstrate and maintain the excellent skills you have and the excellent productivity that you provide because you have the treatment and the accommodations you need.
Yes.
In Avi's case, they were punishing her when they stuck her in the corner. In your case, you wanted to be in a corner because it helped you shut out noise that was causing you stress.
No. I don't know a whole lot, but it seems to me that Alaska is very supportive of people with mental health.
I think they are. I think the state is,
I've not seen anything, any program like what I have at the web anywhere down south. Mm-hmm. This is the web is a drop-in center for homeless, addicted, people suffering mental health, people just down on their luck. Mm-hmm. We do what we can to support them. We give them, you know, they have a place to cook, watch TV, work on the computers, play on the computer. Just be themselves. Warm place, dry place. I got a lot of help up here. I moved up here after my husband passed away because if I stayed in Colorado, I'd have gone back to drugs. And so I moved up here and I found JAMI, which is Juno Alliance for Mental Health Institute, and they were very good to me, and they I had a really good counselor. He did art therapy with me. He wasn't an art therapist, but I would do art stuff.
Anyway,
I would do art stuff. I'd make a project on an issue I was having, and we'd talk about it. Mm-hmm. And just doing that helped the symptoms some.
One of the reasons why people, the community in general, think that people with mental illness are hopeless. You know, it's no point to pour in money into them because they're always going to be sick and crazy. But what's happened is in the last 10 or 15 years, we've had a revolution in treatments. EMDR is a new treatment. Dialectic behavior therapy is a new treatment. And in new medications. And so there's many more people recover from mental illness, not meaning they cure, they don't get rid of the mental illness, but we recover from the mental illness many more than a lot of other illnesses in the country.
And on that really positive note, we need to wrap up. Thank you all very much for sharing your stories and your experiences and for making it known that recovery is real and people with mental illness are simply part of our community.
That was Community in Unity, Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue series. This episode focused on living with a mental illness and was recorded on February 16, 2017 in the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage. You can listen again at alaskapublic.org.